She used to write down words from full of thoughts in a notebook and chose words from them to put into her songs as lyrics, like a puzzle. During her lifetime, she used to say, "I've always cherished the words and lyrics. I hope my music can convey that." She always cared about lyrics and how to convey her feelings through her singing. Despite having little media exposure and only 7 television appearances, she moved the hearts of many people with her music. She was shy and not good at speaking her mind, but she put all her feeling into her songs, which is why I believe her music continues to resonate with so many people. So let's move on to the next song. This song was released in 1996 and was the ending theme for the TV anime Slam Dunk. So if you're a fan of anime, you might recognize this song. Without further ado, here's My Friend by Zard.
Thank you.
was my friend by Zard. I'm very glad to share one of my favorite Japanese artists with you today. She has many other great songs too, so if you're interested in, you can listen to her music on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Music. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ayu. That was a great introduction to Zard. She has a lot of material, or they have a lot of material. Zard is the name of the band. What's the name of the singer again?
Oh, Zard, and her name is Izumi Sakai.
Yeah. There's a lot of material on YouTube if you want to investigate this artist more. Thanks for bringing us that to us. We're going to quickly play you Bird Note, and then we'll be on with Looking at Lime.
This is Bird Note. When we look for robins in spring and early summer, we often see them with their beaks full of earthworms. That tasty payload tells us a couple of things. For one thing, there's a nest full of baby birds nearby, waiting for their next meal. But that beak full of worms is also a clue about the conditions in which robins choose to nest. It turns out that robins are pretty choosy about this. When scientists looked at climate data for over 8,500 robins' nests in many parts of the U.S., they found that temperature is important. Robins will nest only if the mean noon temperature is between 45 and 65 degrees. But even more critical is relative humidity. It needs to be right around 50% in the middle of the day. And if it isn't, the birds will hold off. What's so special about this combination of temperature and humidity? It's the sweet spot when soft invertebrates move up near the surface of the soil. Like earthworms, essential fuel for hungry nestlings. As for exactly how robins sense when the humidity is 50%, that's still an open question. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day. And you can get the sights as well. Foraging in the woods, searching for edible treasures emerging from the soil. What happens when we dig underground and look at the diversity of living creatures and microbes? On this episode, we're examining the connection between soil, antibiotics, and Borrelia burgdorferi, the bacteria that leads to Lyme disease. Dr. Kim Lewis is a researcher specializing in molecular science. He studies persister cells that lead to tolerance to antibiotics, uncultured bacteria of the environment, and the microbiome. Dr. Lewis is a university distinguished professor and director of the Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern University in Boston. Dr. Lewis also works on drug discovery, which is the process through which new medicines are identified. He joins us today from Boston. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Sarah.
How did you become interested in studying Borrelia burgdorferi?
Well, my lab has been working on a number of infectious diseases, and I've been watching what's happening in the field of Lyme. And not much has been happening from my perspective. I mean, the pathogen that causes Lyme disease was very well defined as Borrelia burgdorferi. The treatment is pretty short with standard antibiotic doxycycline. But then a part of the patients, about 10%, go on to develop a condition that we do not understand very well, a chronic Lyme. And that's what piqued my interest to this disease.
Yes, well, I think many people would certainly agree with you that there hasn't been enough research done in this field. How did your research lead you to working with soil in relation to studying microbes?
Right. Well, most antibiotics that we currently have in the clinic come from soil microorganisms. So you'll recall, penicillin, tetracycline, streptomycin. These are all probably common names that everybody recognizes. Soil microorganisms, bacteria and microfungi, as we call them, they compete with each other, and they fight out their differences with antibiotics. And then we borrow these compounds from them and use them to fight our pathogens.
So it's this whole battle that's happening underground that you're studying.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that's amazing. And when you're working with soil, is the research methodology somehow different as opposed to just looking at microbes in a petri dish?
Well, it's only different in the sense that you need to isolate bacteria from soil. Therein lies a bit of a conundrum because only about 1% of bacteria that live in soil are going to grow on our petri dishes, and the rest are called uncultured or the microbial dark matter. And so that's one of the things that attracted me to this field. And we, with my colleague Slava Epstein, developed methods to grow these mysterious dark matter bacteria.
That sounds very intriguing. I definitely want to learn more about that.
So the phenomenon itself was described in late 19th century. So it's the oldest unsolved problem in microbiology. And of course, you know, people spent a long time, 100 years to be exact, tinkering with the media, trying to see if you had this or that, maybe you'll get more growth. But that didn't work out. So then we decided we'll do something different. We will grow soil bacteria where we know for a fact that they will grow, and that is in their natural environment. So we came up with a simple gadget, and we call it the diffusion chamber, where you take a sample of soil, you get the bacterial cells from that sample by simply shaking it with a little bit of water. And then those bacteria, we sandwich them between two semi-permeable membranes. And that device goes back into the soil. So now small molecules can pass through the pores of those semi-permeable membranes, but cells cannot. So now we have captured bacteria, and we're growing them essentially in a sterile environment and inside that chamber. We trick them because they don't know that something happened to them. They're in full contact with the molecules from their environment. And not surprisingly, they grow. Once they grow, then we can adapt them to growth on the petri dish. We call that domestication.
Domestication. I like that. And so what is the new antibiotic that you're looking at now that might be potentially used for treating Borrelia eventually?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So we realized that some of the problems with antibiotics in general, and specifically with Lyme disease, is that antibiotics, while they will kill your pathogens, they will also in the process wreck your microbiome. So as we now more and more appreciate, they're useful bacteria or symbionts that live in the gut and affect almost every aspect of health and disease. And so we had a reason to believe that chronic Lyme, at least one component of chronic Lyme, may be a consequence of that wrecking of the microbiome when you're treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. The only way to properly test that hypothesis, actually, is to get an antibiotic that only kills Borrelia burgdorferi, nothing else, doesn't harm your microbiome, and then see whether treating patients with that compound will prevent development of PTLDS. The immediate advantage, the immediate benefit to the patient from such a compound will be, of course, that you're not going to have side effects of damaging the microbiome, whether or not it's linked to chronic Lyme. Anyway, so we set out to search for such a compound, and we placed a bet on Mother Nature, if you will, betting that nature would bother to evolve a compound that selectively kills spirochetes that live in the soil. Borrelia burgdorferi has a spirochete, right? It's sort of a spiral-shaped bacteria, a special group of bacteria. And so we started testing a soil bacteria from our collection against Borrelia burgdorferi for their ability to inhibit its growth. And in parallel, we tested them against some other common bacteria, staph. So everything that that killed Borrelia and staph, we were not interested in. That's your typical broad-spectrum antibiotic like doxycycline that's used to treat Lyme disease. And then we hit upon a particular bacteria, Streptomyces hygroscopicus, that was making something that only hit Borrelia burgdorferi, but not staph. So it was making a selective antispirochetal compound. And I was convinced that this is going to be a novel molecule because we don't know of any natural product antibiotic with that unusual property, only killing spirochetes. But then when we determined the structure of this compound, it turns out that it's an old abandoned antibiotic called Hygromycin A, discovered in 1953. So a very long time ago. And the reason I never heard of it, even though, you know, I study antibiotics all my life, is because it's a lousy antibiotic from a conventional perspective. You know, it has very poor activity against our common pathogens, like, you know, staph and strep and E. coli. But it's exquisitely potent against spirochetes, like Borrelia burgdorferi, or the spirochete Treponema pallidum that causes syphilis. So that's how we found this compound.
Oh, that's amazing. And that it's exquisitely potent and that it actually differentiates and targets the spirochetes sound very significant for your research.
Yep.
And what are biofilms?
Biofilms. So biofilms are it's a mass of bacterial cells. Let's say a typical case, you have a catheter, and then it got contaminated with a bacteria. And that bacterial cell forms a colony, a mass of cells. That mass of cells covers themselves with an exopolymer, commonly known as gunk or something like that. slime is a better word, probably.
Okay.
Slime, right. And that becomes extremely difficult to treat with antibiotics because most antibiotics don't act completely alone. They act sort of in concert with the immune system. So antibiotics kill some bacteria, then the immune system kills some bacteria, and you clear the infection. But this slime prevents the immune system from reaching into the biofilm. So now you need an antibiotic that will kill all bacteria. But that's very difficult to do because all bacterial species produce the small subpopulation of dormant cells that we actually discovered in the biofilm, which explains why the biofilm infection is often chronic and so difficult to treat.
And when you look under the microscope, what do those biofilms actually look like? Can you see them?
Yes, of course. So it looks like the surface layer is going to be the slime. And then under the surface layer, there are going to be cells. And often the biofilm has a sophisticated architecture with columns of cells and channels where liquid and nutrients can pass throughout the biofilm.
That's amazing. And then you've also been looking at persister cells. How do those function?
Yes. So I briefly mentioned those. The way those function is they go into dormancy. So let's say there's a growing population of cells like E. coli or staph. And then one thing that happens in all cells, including our cells, there is... some genes that that have to be turned on in order for the cell to make proteins or to make energy. Those genes randomly turn off. It's sort of a low probability random event. We call that noise, molecular noise, if you will. Now you got a cell where a gene that was supposed to be on and helping to churn out energy, that gene is off. So that cell goes into temporary dormancy. Well, while it went into dormancy, antibiotics cannot kill it because antibiotics kill active cells. They need active functions to corrupt them and kill. And you get to this small subpopulation of cells that survives a hit of antibiotic. When antibiotic concentration drops, those are the cells that are going to survive. They, mm-hmm. the biofilm or the population in the blood or whatever. And so you get a difficult to treat relapsing infection.
And are the Borrelia persister cells quite different then from other microbes?
No, they're not. So we studied persister cells of Borrelia. They are in principle similar. There are also genes that are noisy, and it's the energy producing genes that turn off with low probability and produce persisters that survive hit by antibiotics.
And do you see a difference in persister cells between acute or chronic Lyme?
Well, you see, in acute Lyme, of course, you have the pathogen, you have a mix of regular cells and persisters. In chronic Lyme, one of the very difficult issues with chronic Lyme is that we cannot detect the pathogen in patients with chronic Lyme. We cannot culture it or identify by other methods. So whether it's there or not, we do not know. It's possible that some cells are hiding somewhere. But it's also possible that the pathogen and treatment with broad spectrum antibiotics have wrecked the immune system, and now you're getting something that looks like an autoimmune disease or like long COVID, where the virus is probably gone from patients with long COVID. Again, it cannot be detected, but the symptoms very, very similar to symptoms of chronic Lyme persist.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, the similarities, really. Are there other strategies to eradicate persister cells?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. So one is, in a way, straightforward. So a number of years ago, we identified a antimicrobial compound that actually kills persisters. So it kills both regular cells and dormant cells. This compound has an amazing mechanism of action. It turns on degradation of proteins in the bacterial cell, and now the bacterial cell digests itself, right? So commits suicide. Probably one of the most amazing mechanisms of actions for antibiotics that I know. Anyway, so while that's all, that compound, it's with a long name, acyldepsipeptide. It is now in development for staph and several other common pathogens, but unfortunately it doesn't act against Borrelia burgdorferi. So that's one approach. But we, of course, are on the hunt for other compounds that are going to have an ability to kill persisters of spirochetes as well. But the other approach it doesn't require any new antibiotics. So the other approach is based on the idea of pulse dosing, that we actually tested in a biofilm formed by staph, and it works pretty well in that case. And also in a test tube, also sterilizes Borrelia burgdorferi in a test tube, including its persisters. So you have, let's say, a population of bacteria in the test tube, regular cells and persisters. You add an antibiotic, something like amoxicillin, a conventional antibiotic. Kills regular cells, persisters are alive. Now you wash away the antibiotic, allow the persister cells to wake up, but not to restore the initial population. So now they're vulnerable, and you hit them with the next dose. You repeat that pulsing a couple of times, and you completely eradicate the population. So that is an example of how you can, by sort of clever dosing, you could, in principle, get rid of persisters.
That's great. What is next for you in the stages of drug discovery? That you can share with us.
Right, sure. Sure. I understand. So I cannot tell you everything because time and your viewers, though patient, I'm sure have a certain attention span. I'll tell you one thing that I'm pretty excited about at the moment and that my team is working on. So we've been wondering, is there a group of bacteria on planet Earth that has the same requirements for antibiotics as we do? What is our current need in antibiotics? The current need is for compounds that are going to be non-toxic, that are going to be effective against particularly nasty pathogens like gram-negative bacteria, and Borrelia falls into that category. Not much compounds discovered against that. Very tough to find anything new against that group. It's going to travel through the tissue, so it would be systemically available. All those good things that we expect from an antibiotic. So we're wondering if there's a group of bacteria that actually had to acquire antibiotics with exactly these properties. And we hit upon such a group of bacteria. And these are symbionts that live in the gut of nematodes. So nematodes are little worms that live in the earth. Many of these nematodes, the ones that we're particularly interested in, they're called entomopathogenic nematodes. They infect insect larvae. The larvae release antibiotics and help protect that food source. And then the nematode and this bacteria called Photorhabdus eats up the larvae. But these compounds that the Photorhabdus releases, they have to be able to travel through the tissues of the nematode. They have to be non-toxic to the little worm, and they have to be able to kill the nasty bacteria that attack that food source. And those bacteria are very similar to our pathogens. So that sort of fulfills that entire list. Now, these nematodes, by the way, you can buy them on Amazon. Yeah, they're sold on Amazon for gardeners. You can sort of take those nematodes, sprinkle your favorite, and it will not be chewed up by insects. So we went looking for new antibiotics in that group of bacteria, and we found several new antibiotics. One class, really, really fantastically interesting compounds that we published 2 years ago, Darobactins. And now we have two more groups of bacteria coming out of that class. And that sort of tells us that looking for creatures that have had similar requirements as we for medicines can be a very productive way of finding new drugs.
Oh, that just sounds remarkable. Well, we will be following all of your research closely and love to have you back on the podcast to tell us more in the future.
Thank you, Sarah.
And that was Looking at Lyme, interview there with Dr. Kim Lewis. Thanks to Looking at Lyme for providing us with that. We're just about out of time here at the show. Peter's going to tell us a little bit about a project he's going to be working on.
Well, I plan to interview Alan Sins. He teaches a course over at UBC,
yep.
Global Issues. It's part of the SPGA, Social Policy and Global Affairs Program, which yep. I'm a bit critical of.
Right.
And I audited his complete course in the autumn of 2022. Yeah. So I'm going to take one of the portable audio boxes and arrange an interview with him.
Great. So if you can sum it down to about 20 seconds, what's your critique of what he's talking about?
I'm critical. He didn't say anything critical about the World Bank, the IMF in his course. I attended every one, and he's just for globalism as general, and he right. and all the students loved him though, but he comes across as being a very progressive, but I have other views on him.
Great. Well, we look forward to that in a future week. You're going to start working on that right away. We're just about out of time. Thank you, Ayu, for your profile on Zard.
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Will be up in just a few moments. stay tuned, and we'll be back next week.
Hi.